Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags. Over the next 30 minutes, I'll bring you the latest headlines from South Africa and around the globe. Whether you are tuning in live or catching the podcast later, please stay with us for in-depth conversation with leading business minds, political influencers, and key newsmakers. It's everything you need to stay informed, quick, sharp, and straight to the point. It's Thursday, the 17th of October. On our program today, another new South African tourism board and also calls for a tourism police force. The tourism minister, Patricia de Lille, is standing by. A financial watchdog orders banks to freeze Bankso accounts on suspicion of it being a criminal enterprise. There's new data out showing how mapping of gun crimes can help reduce violent crime. And homeowners, are you still financially strained? Well, what you can do if you can't afford your bond repayment. Another shake-up at the South African Tourism Organization. Following the resignations of the board last month, the Minister Patricia de Lille now appointing a new members to the board. The resignations reportedly due to internal conflict and disagreement over the management of the agency. Now with a fresh team in place, there are questions though about what the new board is planning to do to address the issues and also most importantly ensure that South African tourism regains its footing both locally and internationally. The Minister is with me now. Minister de Lille, welcome to you. And given that the previous board resigned over what I understand were internal conflicts, how confident are we that the same governance and leadership challenges are not going to affect things going forward this time around?
No, that's not true. They were replaced. I had not even removed them from the board. I removed them from their positions, the chair and the deputy chair. This whole issue, Jeremy, is about board fees. The board, under the leadership of the chair and the deputy chair, had 59 meetings in 6 months. They accrued 900,000 rand of a 1.4 million rand budget for the full year and 6 months. The whole issue was about board fees and excessive meetings. It is when I called a meeting with the board, the full board, that the board chair informed me that, no, minister, we're not spending a lot of money. We've got 5 million rand in for the board. I said, no, you didn't read the budget, because the budget is 5 million, but 1.4 million is allocated for board fees. But be that as it may, all the allegations that they've made, I have appointed an independent investigator to look into those allegations. But this was all about wastage of taxpayers' money. And I've also got oversight duties, and Parliament raised the issue with me in July. So even Parliament raised concern about the number of board meetings and board fees.
Minister, there are other issues I want to get to, but very quickly, this sounds to me like a fast-moving gravy train. Is action being taken, or can action be taken against those who've gone?
Yes, the independent investigator that I've appointed, I've as part of the brief, is to investigate, you know, why all of the board meetings, what was on the agenda, what was discussed. And so once I got that report in the next month or two, I will make that public too, Jeremy.
Minister, the Democratic Alliance, and you would have seen the statement today, calling for you to conduct a comprehensive audit of all tourism projects initiated over the past decade. They say a state of neglect of infrastructure intended to bolster, and I'm quoting here, the tourism industry remains unfinished, abandoned, or subjected to vandalism exacerbated by budget inconsistency. You've seen the statement, no doubt. What are you going to do?
Well, now, I've not seen the statement, because I have just had 2 meetings in the past month with the portfolio committee. And I did explain to the portfolio committee that when we presented the previous year's financial statements to them, I came into this department in 2023. And I said to them, I've inherited a department and a SAT board, but with the garbage and with the baggage. But I can't say it wasn't under my watch. I have to fix it. I then showed the portfolio committee in the case of SAT the investigations that we have done, and that now I have written to the president to apply for a proclamation to investigate so that we can even recover some of the money. We've taken consequence management, and one of the executives has already been dismissed. It's a very general statement. I have to see the specifics. But this is what I found in the Department of Tourism. The Department of Tourism simply have infrastructure projects, but they appoint implementing agents to do the work. I have reviewed the contract with the Development Bank of Southern Africa that sits with most of the projects. Yes, some of the projects have not even been started, and I've taken that out. And we have changed the service level agreement with Development Bank. But there's six other implementing agencies. What we've also done was to bring capacity within the department, build environment capacity that can have oversight over these projects. And so we have already employed two built environment professionals. We got permission from the Department of Public Service and Administration to appoint another two. So I have now fixed the internal capacity of the Department of Tourism so that we can avoid all of the wastage and overruns and over budget. But there are some of the other projects that are, you know, that I went to go and visit myself to also, that are now ready for handover. So the report is with the all the members of the portfolio committee.
Minister, my final issue: are we going to see this tourism police unit come into effect?
Well, you know what? I just wish sometimes people can read and read properly. And I'm very disappointed, you know, especially if it comes from the Fourth Estate. Because in the statement that we've released on the white paper, it was gazetted on the 18th of September. And we had over 3,500 comments and inputs. And one of the proposals in the white paper, it states very clearly a dedicated tourism safety support in partnership with law enforcement agency at all levels to investigate the establishment of a specialized police unit with capacity. In no way does the tourism white paper say that the safety of tourists need to be regarded more than the safety of all records, I mean, of all residents. I'm on the record, and I've said that many times, that the safety and security is the mandate of the police to ensure that all South Africans are safe, and that including our visitors. But I also had to admit to say there is a perception for potential tourists to want to visit our country, that South Africa is not safe. And therefore, last year, the department invested 174 million. We employed 2,300 tourism monitors. And we're working together with the private sector. And we have a plan that we have shared with all the embassies and consulates in South Africa. We shared it with all our missions abroad, you know, to say to potential tourists, yes, come. This is the safety plans that we've put in place, because we want people, including South Africans, to feel safe in our own country. So it has to be investigated. Further consultations need to take place. We have to engage with the Minister of Police. So the proposal that came from one of the people who interacted during the public participation was to say investigate the establishment of a specialized police unit. And that's exactly what I will be doing, Jeremy.
Minister Patricia DeLille, as always, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The Financial Intelligence Center has ordered three banks to freeze all the bank accounts of the controversial Contracts for Difference trading platform called Bankso. The FIC believes the company is, in its words, a criminal enterprise designed to defraud innocent members of the public. MoneyWeb editor Reik van Niekerk has been in the trenches on this story for some time. And Reik, first of all then, can you explain what a CFD trading platform like Bankso actually does and why it's so controversial?
It's a very complex investment, if you can call it that, platform. And any individual who uses or wants to trade in CFDs need to know about the risks. Now, you don't, if for example you would invest or trade in a CFD linked to gold, you don't actually invest in gold. You take a bet that the price of gold may move in the short term, say from $2,600 to $2,605. It can be very, very short term, sometimes minutes. And then when it moves in the right direction, you can make a lot of money, a lot more than what you invested because it's leveraged. But if the price goes against you, you can lose a lot more money than you wagered. And it's very, very risky investment options.
So that's the background. What then are the main concerns that have been raised by the Financial Sector Conduct Authority as far as this organization is concerned?
Well, Bankso, let me just go back and tell you who and what Bankso is. Now, there are many CFD platforms around the world aimed at experienced traders. Now, they opened a platform in South Africa around 2022. And they try to onboard clients. Of course, they need clients to make money. And then the controversial part starts. They started to advertise, or let me rephrase that, a company called Immediate Matrix, which we don't know if it is related to Bankso or not. They deny it strongly. They published those fake ads on social media that Elon Musk, he has developed this AI bot and it can turn an initial investment of 4,700 rand into a monthly return of 300,000 rand. Click here. And then when you click and you register.
Luring in the gullible, yeah.
Absolute clickbait. And when you click, and I've done this about 7 or 8 times, it takes seconds, and a Bankso agent phones you and say, listen, sign up. And they try to get you to invest the first 4,700 rand.
And Rick, it's a hard sell they come at you with.
Well, you believe you are going to be in the hands of Elon Musk or Johan Rupert or Patrice Motsepe, and that's your mindset. Mm. And 4,700 rand for many people is not a lot of money. But then after you've invested, the party starts because they become very, very aggressive and ask you to put in more money and a lot more money than 4,700 rand. I've got in my inbox this morning two people who've lost over R1 million each because every time you put in money and you lose it, they tell you, listen, don't worry, just put in more money and we will then make up your losses.
So it's the sales then becomes almost a form of harassment, is what you're saying.
Well, they exploit the naive is maybe a better way to do it. Because you're so invested. If you've lost R500,000 and they tell you, listen, put in another 200,000 and we're going to make back your or recover your 500,000, then, people believe that could happen.
In South Africa, Rick, how many people have fallen for this?
We don't know, but I think it's a significant number. I spoke to many former employees over the past 9 months, and they claim that sometimes they get over 2,000 clients a month, which is significant. And in court papers regarding the FIC's application to freeze or defense of an interdict application from Bankso to have the accounts unfreezed, Bankso acknowledged they have over 7,300 active clients. Now, that is may suggest that they have had many, many more over the past 2 years.
So we've had the freezing of these accounts now. What does the FIC say about this operation? How is it describing Bankso?
They describe it that they have reason to believe that Bankso is a criminal enterprise created to exploit and take money from the naive public. It is a very, very well-run business, and it's very, very focused on extracting money from these people. And they do it through a regulated environment. Remember, Bankso is registered with the FSCA, and they have the necessary licenses to operate. But, you know, I'm yet to meet one single individual who claims that they have made money on this platform, while more than 200 people have contacted me, and they have collectively lost more than 110 million rand.
And not only is it a registered entity, but also has a high-profile presence through sponsorship.
Yes, they sponsor our UFC champion, Dricus du Plessis, and Bafana Bafana, and it's a high-profile company. They've done a lot of marketing.
So Bankso, of course, denying that it's a criminal enterprise. It claims as well, Rick, to have refunded investors. What do we know about that reply or those claims that it's made?
Yeah, in court papers, they've strongly denied any wrongdoing. They issued a statement yesterday stating they cooperated with the investigation by the FSCA, and they will continue to cooperate. But they emphasize that their license has only been provisionally withdrawn. But the narrative remains the same. They deny any wrongdoing. They believe they have the licenses, and they continue to claim innocence.
So there's a trading license then, if I'm understanding, that has been suspended. What are the immediate consequences for the company and perhaps more importantly to clients, many of whom I'm assuming you have spoken to and have recorded their stories?
Well, the stories that are coming through are heartbreaking. You know, there are people who are looking after disabled children who have been defrauded, and the individual who was defrauded battled to pay for this disabled child, and they wanted to just supplement the income in some way for these to get money to look after the child. Now, in the financial world, and any responsible platform needs to do a needs analysis. They need to say, listen, is this platform the right one for you? Now, obviously, somebody who's putting in savings to augment payments to support a disabled child should not invest in CFDs or any risky investment at all. Yet Bankso took money from that individual and many other individuals who've put in their life savings, sold their houses, remortgaged their houses to try and make money from this. And they do not do that analysis at all. And I think that is a transgression of their trading license from this get-go.
You've been working this story, and this is a final question, for a long time. What is the next step, and what's been the reaction to the work that you've done? I'm assuming that you've probably got a lawyer's letter or two.
Yeah, well, that's par for the course. But this is a complicated company, and it slots in within a regulated environment, which is also complicated. Listen, the FSCA investigated this company for 9 months, more than 9 months, and it took them a long time to act. And now action has been taken. Their bank accounts have been frozen, and the asset forfeiture unit has and also pounced, and around 90 million rand, I believe, remained in the accounts. I don't know what's going to happen with that, but it's definitely evident that the authorities believe it's a criminal enterprise. Investigations need to follow. So hopefully something will happen. My inbox, I think this morning I've had about 20 emails from people who've claimed they've lost money, and elderly people. So I think this will, as it's being uncovered, the extent of this operation will become a lot more clear.
Rek van Niekerk, MoneyWeb editor, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
According to the Institute for Security Studies, targeting firearm crime is the fastest way to improve public safety. With the rising number of illegal firearms fueling violent crime, there is now an urgent need, an urgent call for more effective policies and enforcement strategies. David Bruce from the Institute for Security Studies is with us. And David, the report states that targeting firearms or firearm crime is the quickest way to improve things. My question is, what makes firearm crime a more urgent focus than other types?
Right. Well, there's just so many reasons to focus on firearm crime that I could spend in half an hour detailing them. But firearms make a disproportionate contribution to overall levels of death and injury related to crime. In South Africa, the phenomenon, for instance, of mass killings, 18 people killed in Lusikisiki on the 27th of September, 7 people killed in Orange Farm this past weekend. That phenomenon of mass killings is much more possible, much more likely when there's widespread use of firearms in crime. If you look at something like the killings of police are overwhelmingly linked to the use of firearms by criminals. So if we wanted to significantly improve police safety, possibly the best thing we could do is to do something about the overall problem of firearm crime.
David, we have strict gun control laws on paper, but it's where enforcement happens that things fall apart. Why do you think there is such a gap then between the policy, which I think is probably good, and the action resulting from that?
Right, okay. Well, I'd like to start off by just clarifying something here that in many ways, what's happened in South Africa over quite some time has been that the issue of addressing firearms has been seen as synonymous with what is known as gun control. But what we're focusing on is something slightly different from that, which is what the police themselves can do to reduce levels of crime involving the use of firearms. So that is speaking to a range of different crimes, including firearm-related murders. There's actually what many people are not aware of is that firearm-related injury outnumbers firearm-related deaths in South Africa. So that makes an enormous impact on the healthcare system, is very costly to the public healthcare system, but also then what's even greater scale is, for instance, the problem of firearm-related robberies. So what we're talking about here is what can the police do to bring down levels of firearm crime? And so the question that you're raising is essentially a question about the discrepancy between policy and implementation. And so we are arguing that this is something that the police can do, but it requires, obviously, an effectively managed strategy which relies on the optimal use of data to, you know, if anything of this kind is going to take place.
So what type of data are we talking about, and what should police be doing in order to recalibrate that paradigm?
Well, it starts off with, you see, one of the critical frontiers, if you want to call it that, of policing in South Africa is the application of information technology. Now, information technology potentially would enable the SAPS to integrate and synthesize the information that it has on firearm crime. So the first thing that it would do would be to make optimum use of information. Secondly, it would need to have effective strategic management of available police resources for addressing firearm crime. A third aspect then would be a question about how to structure that response. So, for instance, what kind of specialized units does one establish? What kind of cooperation does one have with the National Prosecuting Authority? And then there are also these issues to do with, which are characteristically what we focus on when talking about this question, which is about implementation of the Firearms Control Act and strengthening the central firearms registry.
David, in terms of the data, do we have that information, or is it an inability to interpret it?
No, you see, the data recording is imperfect. It's not, it can be strengthened, but routinely weapons are involved in a criminal act that is recorded on the police crime administration system, their database for recording crime. And so, you know, potentially with the available information technology and data that's recorded on existing systems, we could already go a long way, for instance, towards the mapping of firearm crime, which would be a critical step towards. So what we're arguing is that mapping is an essential element of the focused use of resources. It's not one of the facets of firearm crime in South Africa is that there's some provinces where it's much more embedded than in other provinces. And so it's primarily in those provinces like Gauteng, KZN, and the Western Cape, but also increasingly the Eastern Cape, Mpumalanga, that one would initially want to focus any initiative to reduce the overall levels of firearm crime.
Just a final question. Is the environment not so porous, though, and arms so abundant that even if we have stricter control, criminals will still find ways to arm themselves?
Well, perhaps the question that you're asking is a question about the general availability of firearms in South Africa. So we obviously have a problem of an oversupply of firearms.
Yeah.
And so this issue can't be addressed without also incorporating a focus on that issue. And it, ultimately what it goes to is revisiting our overall conversation about the place of firearms in our society. But nevertheless, you know, that should not take us away from the critical point that we are making, that the police could do a lot more to bring down overall levels of firearm crime in South Africa, insofar as they are actually able to do so. They could make South Africa into a far safer country. And so that would obviously be in itself be a profound step towards addressing the broader problem.
David Bruce, thank you very much indeed from the Institute for Security Studies.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
With rising costs and interest rates climbing 67% since 2021, many South African homeowners are feeling the financial strain, particularly when it comes to keeping up with home loan repayments. I'm in conversation now with Herschel Javits, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Javits Properties. And Herschel, this can be a very difficult time for a homeowner. What are the main factors contributing to the stress?
So exactly, the stresses are that since 2007, when we came out of that COVID lockdown, we've had interest rates which fell to historic lows, have increased from 7% to their current 11.5%. Remember, they came down 0.25% last month, so to 11.75%, where they've held for some time. We've had, up until the beginning of this year, significant increases in fuel prices, in electricity prices, in inflation. So consumers have been feeling the squeeze, not only from interest rates, but across all parts of where we spend our daily money, and something has to give. And what has given over a period of time, unfortunately, is that many homeowners are battling to keep up with their home loan repayments. There was a recent article in the publication which put that number of distressed home loans at almost R1 billion.
And that stress, Herschel, I'm correct in saying, is felt across all homeowner demographic, isn't it?
Yeah, Jeremy, so traditionally, you know, we've often seen that financial stress sitting in your first-time buyer's entry level, but there is no doubt that over the last year or two, we've slowly started to see that stress creeping into the middle market and even some parts of the upper market who are normally immune to this sort of interest rate and cost of living stress just because of the cumulative impact of all of them together.
So are there immediate steps that a homeowner must take if they find themselves falling behind on their mortgage payments? And before, Herschel, you even answer that, I would suggest that before you even get to that point, you've got to have an inclination that the stress is starting to rise.
Absolutely. And I think what we find when we're dealing with clients who are financially stressed is that often they've kind of gone through this period of denial. They'll catch it up. They'll sort things out. but very difficult to do. I think what the banks define as financially stressed or the markets is when you're 3 or more months in arrears on your repayments. And so to try and make that up in addition to meeting all of your other obligations is almost impossible.
So what's the first step that you have to take?
So the first step is obviously just to examine your daily costs. And if you can find anywhere to cut costs on your daily lifestyle without taking food off the table and being able to educate your kids, anything that you can do to prevent you falling into arrears and having the possibility of losing your home, you have to do. But many homeowners are finding that almost impossible. So the next step is to be proactive, is to say, I'm not alone in this process. I'm going to proactively contact my bank, have a conversation with them about my financial situation and see what options there are. And the banks have learned, as have consumers. In the financial crisis 2007-2008, many homeowners were forced to forfeit their homes back to the banks. It's a lose-lose for the economy, for the residential market, for homeowners, and for the banks. And so what the banks have done very proactively over the last number of years is introduced what they call their distress sales programs, whereby if you agree completely voluntarily to sell your home in order to get out of this financially stressed situation, they've come up with some innovative options that substantially will assist you. So, for example, if there's a shortfall on the net proceeds of your home versus what you owe, so let's assume you owe the bank R1 million, the net proceeds on the sale of your home is R800,000, you owe the bank R200,000, what the banks will do is, number one, potentially offer you a discount on that shortfall as much as 20% or 30% that they would be prepared to write off of that R200,000. What they'll also do is assess your affordability. So they'll say, based on your current affordability, we're going to arrange repayments on the balance of that shortfall over an extended period of time, sometimes up to 10 years, at very, very favorable interest rates. And what it allows homeowners to do is to get themselves out of this significant financial stress, to avoid having a judgment. And when their financial situation improves, they can re-enter the residential market.
I'm correct in saying that repossession for any financial institution is always the avenue of last resort.
Absolutely, Jeremy. And as you mentioned right up front, it's emotionally stressful. It's something that the banks, they lose money financially. They don't want to. They lose relationship with the client. So it's a lose-lose across all stakeholders in the residential market, including the banks.
Herschel, what about engaging with an estate agent to help?
So the banks have engaged with certain estate agents in terms of assisting sellers to get onto these programs. So my advice would be that if you are financially distressed, if you are in arrears on your program, to ask the estate agent that you're working with, if you are working with one, to see whether they have access to these bank programs. And if they do, can they introduce you to the bank? And if not, to contact the bank directly and to have that conversation with them directly.
Maybe this is also a good time to just get your gauge on the market. We've seen an interest rate reduction, possibly another one. Is this a good time now, whether it's a distressed homeowner or, I guess, for anyone, to sell, or should we consider holding for the time being? What's your reading of the tea leaves here?
So the challenge with financially distressed markets and homeowners is that they're financially stressed because the market's tough, interest rates are high. So it's never a good time to sell if you're financially stressed. And especially in the current market, prices aren't particularly good in almost all parts of the country. So if you can hold on to your home, if you don't have to sell, this is probably not a good time to sell. But we're definitely seeing some green shoots. We're definitely seeing some shifts in confidence. So interest rates have started to come down. Inflation is cooling. Politically, things seem to be more favorable. And as we know, the lights have stayed on, and it's hard to be an optimist in the dark. So we're definitely seeing an increase in activity, in buyer interest. And if it continues, at some point, it's going to translate into better price growth and a better time to sell for homeowners, especially if you're financially stressed.
You know, Herschel, if I had a rand for every time someone said they're seeing a green shoot as far as the economy is concerned, I would be able to afford a very expensive house. Good talking to you as always, Herschel Javits, Chief Executive Officer of Javits Properties. On our last online poll, multi-choice under increasing churn pressure, 9% of our respondents saying, I'm going, I'm leaving the platform, 46% I'm gone, and 45% say they stay for news and sport. In the on the poll today, talk of a specialist tourism police unit. Do you think it's a good idea? Wouldn't work, or the SAPS should rather up their game? If you have a view on that, you can participate either on X or LinkedIn. That is our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.